Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Shopology on Edge Radio. I'm Dr. Louise Grimmer from the University of Tasmania. And each week on this show, we dive into the world of retailing, marketing and consumer behaviour. On this week's show, we're looking at the likely impact of the latest lockdown in Melbourne on the state's retail sector and what effect it will likely have on retailing around the country as well. I'll be chatting with retail expert and academic Dr. Jason Pallant from Swinburne University of Technology. And also this week, I'm presenting the second in our series on the history of department stores. This week's store is Liberty of London, possibly my favourite department store. That's coming up later. But first, let's take a look at what's making news headlines in the retail world. Making retail headlines this week, the booming industry for fake meat could deliver a big win for Australian business. Killian Plastow, reporting for The New Daily, writes global demand for meat is expected to soar, potentially creating a multi-billion dollar secondary market for plant-based alternatives. Fake meat requires fewer inputs than animal-based products. For example, research from the University of Michigan found that a plant-based Beyond Burger patty is made with 99% less water, 93% less land, and 46% less energy than a standard quarter-pound beef patty. This presents an opportunity for Australian farmers. The domestic agricultural sector has the capacity to produce the necessary ingredients for meat substitutes, as well as a reputation for quality produce, making it an attractive prospect for importers. Australians are among the most voracious meat eaters on the planet, consuming nearly 100 kilograms per capita in 2019. But that figure has actually been shrinking in recent years as red meat becomes more expensive and plant-based alternatives become more affordable and closer in taste and texture to their animal equivalents. Modelling conducted by Deloitte Access Economics for independent think tank Food Frontier conservatively estimates plant-based meat products will generate $1.4 billion in domestic retail sales by 2030. And in other retail news this week, administrators for collapsed retailer TM Lewin Australia are considering reopening stores in Brisbane and Sydney as potential buyers circle the business. Matthew Elmas, reporting for Smart Company, writes that the formalwear chain, which appointed administrators from Ernst & Young earlier this month, owes about 70 creditors approximately $10 million, 86% of which is tied to its UK-based parent, owned by private equity firm Talk Brands. TM Lewin Australia's five stores have been closed since March due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but the company's 40 workers remain employed and are receiving JobKeeper payments. A number of unsolicited approaches have already been made ahead of a formal sale process, but administrators declined to clarify the number or type of those approaches. What drove TM Lewin to the retail ICU? A mix of factors, administrators say, including declining CBD foot traffic due to the coronavirus crisis locally and the collapse of TM Lewin in the UK several months ago. The company's UK parent closed its 66 stores in March and later laid off 600 workers in a pre-pack administration deal in late June. Administrators for TM Lewin Australia did not say whether Talk Brands is interested in purchasing the local business. TM Lewin Australia is just the latest retail business to fall on tough times amid the coronavirus outbreak, with the likes of Seafolly, G-Star Raw, Tiger Lily and ASX-listed PAS Group also restructuring in recent months. In other news this week, Australia's richest family has just sealed a $1 billion deal. Julianne Sprague, writing for the Australian Financial Review, reports that Visy, the company owned by billionaire Anthony Pratt, is acquiring Australia and New Zealand's largest glass bottle and container manufacturing business in a deal worth nearly $1 billion. In a statement issued today, Visy said it was buying Owens, Illinois in what is one of the biggest manufacturing acquisitions by an Australian-owned business in the nation's history. Owens, Illinois is the largest manufacturer of glass bottles and containers in Australia and New Zealand, with factories in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide and Auckland. Mr. Pratt, Visy Executive Chairman, with an estimated wealth of $17.4 billion, said he planned to increase Owens, Illinois' recycled content of glass bottles animals from one-third to two-thirds. Visy is one of the world's largest privately owned recycling and packaging companies. The deal is expected to be completed by the end of this month, and post-acquisition, Visy is tipped to employ 7,200 people. And that's what was making retail headlines this week. I'm Louise Grimmer, and you're listening to Shopology on Edge Radio 99.3 and online at edgeradio.org.au. As Melbourne is in lockdown again, we can take some of the lessons learned from the first lockdown to predict what might happen this time for retailers and consumers. To tell us more about what we can expect, my special guest this week is Dr. Jason Pallant, retail expert from Swinburne University of Technology, and I spoke with him earlier.
Jason, you live in Melbourne, and so I think you're ideally placed to give us some of the insights into the impact of this latest lockdown in Melbourne on the retail sector there. Before we discuss this latest lockdown, I wanted to look with you at what happened last time. So how was the retail sector, I guess, around the country affected the last time we were in this sort of countrywide lockdown?
Yeah, so I think what's really interesting about Melbourne Lockdown 2.0 is that we actually now have some available data and evidence that we can actually sort of predict what is likely to happen as a result of this. So, the ABS has been tracking retail sales, and we've got a few months of that now, and some other research firms have been tracking things like consumer confidence and spending habits. So we actually think we're able to predict what is likely to happen. Unfortunately, it's not a great story, and so we hope the predictions are wrong. But if we look at what happened last time, I think we saw an initial really big spike of sales in March, which was when things were starting to be announced, case numbers were increasing, but we weren't yet sort of in lockdown, if you will, across the country or even in Melbourne. And what that came down to primarily was people stocking up on food and household goods. So those categories really massively increased as people were stocking up. And of course, we saw the examples of panic buying, if we call it that, people stocking up on, your toilet paper and hand soap and those sort of things, but also long life foods, because we just really didn't know, nobody really knew what to expect. We didn't know how long we were going to be locked down. We saw things like, Italians not being able to leave their homes, singing to each other. And so we weren't sure in Australia what it was going to look like. So we saw those big spikes, but the big spikes were only in some categories, right? And so others like cafes, clothing, department stores massively crashed. And so what was happening is people were shifting away from anything that they saw as discretionary or non-essential and just putting it into, survival mode, preparing for hibernation almost. So that was what we saw in the first month as things were being announced. We then saw a massive crash across the entire industry, with the exception of food, but even food did decline somewhat because people had already done all of the stock up. And what was interesting was that Victoria had the biggest hit. So we were down 21% in a single month, which I should note is seasonally adjusted figures, which accounts for a lot of, the differences we would already see. Usually seasonally adjusted figures for ABS go up or down like 0.3%, and people think it's huge. And we're talking about 21% declines. It's humongous, right? So it's why we saw so many impacts. And so April was really when we were all in lockdown, or, we had our four reasons we could leave the house. And so we saw that reflected in sales figures. And then things have started to improve in May, which was the data that was recently released. Like clothing, footwear and accessories, which is a category the ABS do, went up 129%. So from nearly nothing to doubling in a month, and so did department stores. So essentially from a spending case, We went into a hibernation. We stocked up, then we did nothing. We didn't, we didn't spend. And then we slowly started to reemerge. But obviously, at least for Melbourne, we're now sort of back at that square one of you know, back into those stage three restrictions.
What happened with consumer confidence during that time? It sort of peaked and troughed as we moved through, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And so it followed a similar pattern to retail sales, with the exception of when we first sort of thought we were going to go into lockdown and we saw that increase in retail spending, that was when consumer confidence like really plummeted and really hit some very low points that, that, you know, the Roy Morgan, the tracker, hadn't seen those sort of figures for a long time.
Wow.
And that continued. So March and April, consumer confidence was really down. I think that explains, as you said, a lot of why we weren't spending, but also why we were shifting spending. And so it started to improve. Again, May and June, we saw some slow increases, still lower than it had been, you know, at the start of the year, and what we call PC or pre-COVID. The preliminary results for July, which have only just been released recently, actually show it is down again. And that's on a national level. So even though it's just Melbourne at the moment going back into lockdown, I think because we're seeing case numbers increase, even if it's just here, and we're starting to see things sort of creep around with, you know, a pub in New South Wales getting a bit of a spike and these sort of things, I think people are just really unsure because nobody knows. We don't know what's going to happen. There could be a small outbreak somewhere and suddenly a different state is in lockdown as well. We don't know. You know, we've been told it's 6 weeks, but we've been told it's 6 weeks at a minimum. You know, so all we know is that it's definitely at least 6 weeks. And so it's not surprising that consumer confidence is really down. And as you said, you know, a lot of the other market research firms have been tracking, you know, what consumers are saying that they're doing and the kind of products that they're buying. And, you know, people are saying they're a lot more price conscious. So they're trying not to waste money because, again, consumer confidence is not just about, you know, when will stores reopen or when we'll be allowed to go to the pubs. It's, you know, will I have a job?
That's what I was going to say. A lot of people are actually really unsure because they don't really know what the future holds, do they? I mean, even if we talk about you and I in the higher education sector, we don't really know what's going to happen to our jobs, do we? And a lot of people are thinking, well, I've got to stop spending money at the moment because I might need that, you know, in the medium to long term. I think that's having a huge impact, isn't it?
Huge impact. And even we've got, you know, we see that things like we're losing the free childcare. I think
that's lost, as of today, recording this. Yes.
So that's a lot of families paying for a lot of childcare again. And so either that means a great expense for those families, or, you know, we saw last time a lot of families pull their kids out of childcare because, you know, their own job wasn't secure and so they didn't want that expense. But of course, that has a flow-on effect to all the people that work in those childcare centres. And you know, we've also, you know, there's been some mention that something might happen with JobKeeper to extend it or do something to it, but we don't know for certain. And so if people are keeping their jobs through some of those schemes, I think it is just a really big unknown. And so it's not surprising that people are not going out and buying things as much as they used to on retail. That's right, they don't see as essential.
That's right. I was listening to the ABC News this morning, and the government's announced that they're making some one-off $750 payments to people on the pension and people who are getting, I think it's family tax benefit A and B. But the problem with that is obviously the government wants people to, they want that to stimulate spending. They want people to go out and spend that money. But for a lot of people, they're going to think, okay, great, I've got this payment, I'm going to hold on to it. I don't know if I'm going to need it down the track. So I think there's an element of risk there with that sort of strategy too, isn't there? We might not see that money end up in the cash registers of retail stores.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we do, I think it will be very category specific as we saw last time. You know, I think if people are worried about money at the moment and they get some, they're probably going to be using it on what they see is the essentials. So stocking up the pantry, making sure you have food in your house, stocking up on key medicines and health kind of things.
Face masks,
you know, we're being now told we need to wear them outside the house in Melbourne. And so you know, that's the new sort of panic buying that's happening that we're seeing, people rushing out, trying to find, you know, find masks and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I'm predicting that we're going to see a lot of more declines in a lot of the retail categories. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think so.
Talking about how, I guess, retailers and hospitality businesses as well pivoted last time during the lockdown, what were some of the main changes that we saw in retailing and hospitality?
Yeah, so we saw a bit of almost a fight versus flight kind of response. I think for a lot of retailers, and particularly a lot of the larger chains that have really big overheads and a lot of expenses and a lot of, you know, rental spaces for giant stores, we obviously saw a lot of store closures. I think that comes down to a few things. One is obviously, you know, people being told to stay home, and there was obviously a risk of a virus. And so, you know, there's some health risks and staff not wanting to work and not people not feeling comfortable going there. You know, there's also an economic component to that where it's just expensive to operate a store if you've got no customers. Right. And so we saw a lot of the big retailers just shut their stores and rely on their online offers to try to maintain some connection with customers. But even then, of course, we saw, you know, I think it showed us which retailers had been investing in their online and digital offers over time and which were caught out. You know, we saw stories of various brands locking their websites or putting timers on, or, you know, and obviously huge delivery delays. So even if people were ordering products, who knew when they were going to get there? That was a real challenge, I think, we saw. We obviously saw, you know, a lot of small retailers be really impacted as well, because they might not have that option. You know, if you are a single shop operator and that is your livelihood, you might not be able to make enough of just going online because you might not have that exposure or that brand awareness. But what I was impressed with was, you know, some of the innovations and how resilient we saw some of those smaller businesses. You had one on your podcast a few weeks ago talking about how they turned their, you know, kids and homeware store, you know, pivoted online and personally, you know, putting things in the mailbox and that kind of stuff.
Personal
and
delivery, contactless doorstep delivery. You know, and she did really well during lockdown. Yeah.
That's right. And I think that's where we saw some of the resilience and the value of small local businesses and local retailers, because they can shift. I'll try to avoid using the word pivot.
I know. Sorry. I used
overused.
We must use that word.
But, you know, I think that's what gives me hope that we'll be able to get through this second lockdown is that, you know, I'm hoping that a lot of various retailers and particularly small businesses have figured out, because they were forced to, have figured out a strategy to operate. You know, my therapist, you know, who wasn't allowed to go and treat people, started doing live streams of various exercises and stretches you could do from home. And, you know, we saw that in various places. We saw restaurants and cafes doing, you know, at-home meals or selling off the produce that they had with recipes so that people could do it from home. You know, we saw retailers running online classes and just various things to stay active. So, I'm hoping that those positive things continue and get us through the next 6 weeks.
Do you think there are any key differences, and I guess hospitality is one, but are there any key differences between this lockdown that you guys are going into now and what happened previously?
Yeah, I think the big difference is we know in some ways what to expect, as we've been talking about. Like, we can actually predict what is going to happen in some ways. As we know how consumers will respond. We've got some idea of what retailers could do. But I think the big difference as well is that by learning from that, I think a lot of businesses, whether they be, you know, fashion retailers or they be a bookstore or they be a hospitality cafe, had already put into place a lot of the safety measures that meant they could still operate. So things like physical distancing markers, sanitizers, and all of those kind of things. And so one of the interesting differences here is that at this time is that there's more allowance for businesses to stay open. Like, so there are retailers that still have their doors open because they have already adjusted to some of those things. And, you know, cafes and restaurants can only be takeaway, but they had already adjusted their menus and had already figured out what they were going to offer as takeaway offers. And, of course, they'd started bringing back people into store. But, you know, my local cafes just sort of took down the in-store menu and put back up the takeaway one they were doing 2 weeks earlier. You know, it didn't require that experimentation as much. Mm. I think they've already worked a lot of those things out. They've worked out where are they going to get people to stand to order and pay, and where are they going to get them to stand to wait to pick up things. So I think that's a big difference. And, you know, that does give me some hope that this won't be as bad for some of those local businesses as it was last time.
We know that Victorian retailing accounts for over a quarter of national retail sales, which is actually really significant. And a lot of that's made up by national retailers that operate, I guess, predominantly and extensively in Melbourne. So if we just look at the impact of this lockdown in Melbourne, that's actually going to have a ripple effect, I guess, across the broader retail sector around the country, isn't it? What do you think is going to happen there as a result of this latest lockdown?
Yeah, I think there's a few impacts from that. One is that, you know, that is a really big chunk of retail dollars, and particularly for a lot of the national retailers. And so even though they're able to operate in other states, they're not completely closed this time. That is a really large chunk of operating revenue to be losing. And so we've already seen, you know, retailers going into administration or failing, you know, in recent months. And I wouldn't surprise me to see this cause some more of that, or speeding up some of that as well, because it is a big chunk of revenue to be losing. The other thing that I think we need to remember is that we live in an age where we don't just see local things. We don't just talk to people in our local neighbourhoods. I think consumers nationally see what is happening in Melbourne and see what consumers and retailers and everything are doing in Melbourne. We've already seen from the preliminary Roy Morgan stats that consumer confidence nationally is down, even though this is only happening in Melbourne.
Right.
Yeah, so I think we need to expect that consumers nationally are still going to be very cautious about how they spend, because, you know, Melbourne is an example that if you get complacent and we think things are over, you know, they're not. It's just, unfortunately, the reality of the situation. We're going to be dealing with this for quite a while. And so I think we're going to see some really long-term permanent shifts in consumer behavior, not just here, but nationally, as we try to figure out, I guess, a longer-term solution rather than treading water and just sort of trying to minimize cases. We've already seen it, you know, getting through borders in various ways. So I think, you know, there are national impacts of this lockdown happening again, even though it's just in Melbourne.
Well, Jason Palin, thank you so much for sharing your insights again with us on Shopology. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you as well. And hopefully in the near future, we get to talk about more positive things in retail rather than lockdowns and brand closures.
Absolutely, and not use the word COVID-19. And I guess from all of us at Shopology, we wish all of you guys in Melbourne, you know, the very best for the next 6 weeks, and we're thinking of you. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
That was retail expert Dr. Jason Pallant from Swinburne University of Technology. I'm Louise Grimmer, and you're listening to Shopology on Edge Radio 99.3 and online at edgeradio.org.au. Continuing in our series looking at the history of some well-known department stores, this week's selected store is perhaps my favourite department store of all time, and I'm of course talking about Liberty of London. Liberty is a department store in Great Marlborough Street in the West End of London, just near Carnaby Street. It sells all range of products, including clothing for women, men and children, makeup and perfume, jewellery, accessories, furniture and furnishings, stationery and gifts, and it's very well known for its floral and graphic printed material. Now, the store was the brainchild of a man called Arthur Lazenby Liberty. He was born in Buckinghamshire in the UK in 1843. He was first employed by a small store, Farmer and Rogers, in Regent Street in 1862, the year of the International Exhibition. About 12 years later, in 1874, he decided to start a business of his own, which he did the next year. So he borrowed £2,000 from his future father-in-law, and he accepted the lease on half a store at 218A Regent Street, and he had three staff members. His shop opened during 1875 and it sold ornaments, fabric and objets d'art from Japan and the East. Within 18 months, just 18 months, he'd repaid the loan to his father-in-law and acquired the second half of 218 Regent Street. As his business grew, he bought and added neighbouring properties to his store portfolio. In 1884, he introduced a costume department and created in-house apparel, which really challenged the fashions that were coming out of Paris. In 1885, he acquired 142 to 144 Regent Street, and he housed his ever-increasing product categories that really met the demand for things like carpets and furniture. The store became the most fashionable place to shop in London, and Liberty fabrics were used for both clothing and for furnishings. During the 1890s, Liberty built strong relationships with many English designers, and many of these designers, including people like Archibald Knox, practiced the artistic styles known as arts and crafts and Art Nouveau. And Liberty really helped develop Art Nouveau through the encouragement of these designers. The Tudor Revival building that stands today was built so that trading could continue while renovations were being completed on the other premises. And in 1924, this store was constructed from the timbers of two ships, the HMS Impregnable and the HMS Hindustan. The frontage of the Great Marlborough Street store is actually the same length as the HMS Hindustan, and it's a Grade 2 listed building. The Emporium was designed by Edwin Thomas Hall and his son Edwin Stanley Hall. They designed the building at the height of the 1920s fashion for Tudor Revival. The shop was engineered around three light wells that formed the main focus of the building. Each of these wells was surrounded by smaller rooms to create a homely feel. Many of the rooms had fireplaces, and some of these still exist. Now, sadly, Arthur Liberty died in 1917, 7 years before the completion of his shops. The store, during the 1950s, continued its tradition for fashionable and eclectic design. All departments in the shop had a collection of both contemporary and traditional designs, and that actually continues to this day. In 1955, Liberty began opening several regional stores in other UK cities. The first of these was in Manchester. They then opened stores in Bath, Brighton, Chester, York, Kingston upon Thames, Exeter, and Norwich. But in 1996, Liberty announced the closure of its 20 shops outside London and instead just focused on their flagship store in London and smaller outlets at some airports. Liberty has a history of collaborative projects from William Morris and Dante Gabriel Rossetti in the 19th century to Yves Saint Laurent and Dame Vivienne Westwood in the 20th. Some recent collaborations include brands such as Nike, Doc Martens, Hello Kitty, Barber, Vans, Manolo Blahnik, and Uniqlo. In 2010, Liberty was taken over by private equity firm Blue Gem Capital in a deal worth £32 million. And much of Liberty's revenue now comes from its own brand collections of fabrics, homeware accessories, and ready-to-wear fashion. In 2013, Liberty was the focus of a three-part documentary series called Liberty of London, which aired on Channel 4. The documentary follows Ed Burstall, who's the managing director of Liberty, and the store's retail team in the busy lead-up to Christmas 2013. A second series was commissioned, and this aired in 2014. And if you can get your hands on a copy of the DVD of this documentary, it's really, really fascinating and a wonderful documentary to watch if you're interested in department stores and the characters who work in this particular department store. When you're next in London, I totally recommend a visit to Liberty. There is so much about this historic and at the same time very contemporary store to love. If you want to have a look at Liberty online, if you're not in London, you can have a look at their website. It's libertylondon.com, and it's just an amazing, amazing department store, and I can't recommend it more highly. Next week in the series on department stores, I'll be profiling Selfridges, another London retail institution. You've been listening to Shopology, and that's all for this week's show. I'm Dr. Louise Grimmer. Thanks so much for your company. You can follow the show on Twitter at Shopology Show, and you can follow me at Louise Grimmer. Be sure to catch next week's show. You can listen live every Thursday at 5 o'clock on Edge Radio 99.3 or online at edgeradio.org.au. And you can listen to each episode of Shopology as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show. This really helps other people find us. Till next time, take care.